let's take a Friday break from the news with the question, do Americans cook anymore or just watch other people cook on the Food Channel? Food writer Molly O'Neill says, oh, Americans cook. And she has the research and the mileage to back that up. Molly is a former New York Times columnist and PBS host. She shared her family story with us a few years back in her book, Mostly True, A Memoir of Family, Food, and Baseball, the baseball part being her brother, our favorite former Yankee, Paul O'Neill. But for the past 10 years, Molly O'Neill has been digging into other families' culinary secrets. She's traveled the country, collected over 10,000 recipes, tested a third of them, and has now published 600, along with anecdotes, little-known facts, and pictures, in a new big book, One Big Table, A Portrait of American Cooking. And Molly O'Neill joins us from the NPR studios in New York. We've missed you. Now we know where you've been. Boy, I mean, 10 years of research?
Yeah, I'm one of the slower members of the class.
So what prompted this 10-year search, traveling the country, quizzing food lovers, going to food festivals? Why?
You know, my first book, The New York Cookbook, basically took the same approach. I interviewed people, got their stories, and got their recipes, and I just had a great time doing it. And I knew that I wanted to do it, you know, for the same approach to America. What I didn't know was how much more difficult it would be. But, you know, it's also been such a privilege and an incredible experience.
Well, let's start right at the beginning. There's Maggie Smith Hall in St. Augustine, Florida, letting us know about, is it dattel?
Dattle, yeah.
Dattle peppers. Yeah. That there are people growing window boxes there. And through her and you, we learned that the history of the Menorcans who came to the area in, what, the 1700s. And she makes a Menorcan fromageardis?
It's just a little cheese tart. It makes a fabulous little kind of appetizer or canapé because she uses the dattel pepper in it, and it's intensely, intensely hot. It's as hot as a bird pepper or a little Thai chili pepper. They're very, very hot, but also very fruity tasting. So it's a wonderful appetizer, and she's a great story. I mean, this woman, I think, is a former school teacher who works as a real estate person and is just in love with her heritage and her town, and she approached it through food.
She decided to collect the recipes and make a community notebook.
She also, you know, went back and read old letters and old household diaries. She gives tours in her spare time. I mean, she's just amazing.
Well, and, you know, just on the opposite page from Maggie Smith Hall, you have a piece of history which runs throughout the book in which you remind us that Americans have always eaten on the run.
An early European visitor described Americans as a grab, gobble, and go society, that they were always eating on the run and sort of appalled by that. Of course, we've developed it into an art form and a major national export, but it was news to people in the 18th and 19th century.
But when you read what they were eating in 1677, you know, they were grabbing from vendors, but it was clams, corn, oysters, yams. I mean, it just sounded a lot better.
Well, that was before it got industrialized. Yeah. You've got to get in on the ground floor of these kind of cultural phenomenon, Robin.
Well, you quote Los Angeles food writer Jonathan Gold. He talks about folkloric food, fried chicken and hot dogs, you know, as much about cultural identity as they are about dinner. And then we land on the original deviled egg. Why were they called deviled eggs?
Well, deviling meant that you used a lot of chili pepper or a lot of mustard. Anything hot was diavolo or devil. And the traditional deviled egg either had sort of curry or mustard or a little chili pepper or all of the above.
You use a recipe from 1882 that has no mayo?
I loved that recipe. What happened was, I expect, that deviled eggs were probably originally the yolk was pushed through a ricer, and so it became very fluffy. And then along came commercially produced mayonnaise, which could give that fluffy richness. And the recipe morphed and became mayonnaise-based. But I loved going back to that earlier recipe. It was really delicious.
Well, we'll have to try it, which is what we found ourselves saying a lot when we were going through the book. By the way, the book, Is it 800 pages? Let's see.
I think it's closer to 900. It's 5.2 pounds.
Okay. And it's got big ideas in it as well as, you know, things like deviled eggs. It, you know, talks about the big feasts that communities have. You write about fish boils in Door County, Wisconsin.
Well, I mean, you know, fish boils are pretty standard throughout America, but in Door County, of course, we're dealing with lake fish. And so the boils are a little bit different. Just big, big pots with water and onions, and some people put potatoes and some people don't, and some people put carrots and some people don't. And you layer the fish in and then cover it with water and build a fire under this big old pot and cover it and forget about it while you go do other things.
Yeah.
This makes a wonderful feast for a crowd. West of the Mississippi, there were other, you know, really big meals for crowds. You know, the sort of one-pot dishes really began as sort of feasts. In the East Coast, of course, we have chowder, which was originally a one-pot dinner. And then, of course, we have bean hole beans, the sort of forerunner of baked beans that were baked with molasses and ham hocks in a covered cast iron pot buried in the ground. And I was very skeptical about that. They were great.
You go way out to Oregon for Leslie Scott's twice-baked truffle potato, and you meet a couple out there who say that people were harvesting truffles all wrong in Oregon. They were raking them and tearing them up, and they started this Oregon Truffle Festival to restore them to their rightful place. And it includes a two-day training session for dogs.
Yes, and I was signed up for that this year. I wanted to take, I have bearded collies, and I was so hoping to take Tootsie and Oliver Wendell Woofer out to get trained. But apparently their spots were recently claimed by legitimate truffle dogs.
What is it that they do that is better for the truffle?
First of all, the difference between truffle dogs and truffle pigs is the pigs really want, I mean, first of all, they smell the truffles underground. They're subterranean fungi. And the pigs smell these tubers underground, and the pigs go snorting around and digging them up, and they really want to eat them. And that can be challenging for the truffle person, getting a truffle out of the mouth of a pig. Dogs, on the other hand, are very, very easily convinced that a biscuit or a nice little liver treat is far superior to truffle. And so they're up for the challenge of smelling and pawing around and nosing around and letting you know exactly where to dig. And they would much, much rather have a treat than have a truffle.
Well, whether you get a truffle that way or you buy them, you can find the recipe for Leslie Scott's twice-baked truffle potato at herenow.org. Twice-baked potatoes with anything. So good. Just hollow them out, fill them back up, and bake them. Her new book, One Big Table, 600 recipes culled from 10 years of research around the U.S., filled with all kinds of history. For instance, I did not know that the bundt cake, made in that special bundt pan, just came to be in 1950. It feels like it's been around forever. But, Molly, you say it all began with two women in Minneapolis at a Hadassah luncheon.
Right, who missed their mommy's Kugelhopf.
Which is a much heavier cake from Europe?
Yes, and a much higher cake than our bundt cake. But their desire inspired the manufacture of these pans that just went off the charts. Americans loved them.
Then just a couple pages later, a 13-year-old girl who makes cupcakes in Los Angeles.
Josie!
How do you find her?
Josie is the daughter of a friend of a friend of a friend who declared herself the world's greatest baker when she was about 7 years old. When she was, I think, 11, her mother was remarried and she baked the wedding cake for 150 guests.
And what was special about her cupcakes? Everybody's making cupcakes now.
What I thought was amazing is that she didn't want a whole ton of icing. Most of today's cupcakes are a little cake and a ton of icing, like an Alps mountain of icing. In Josie's considered opinion, a cupcake shouldn't be about the icing. So she makes a very, very beautiful glaze. And she worked really hard to get that cake just right. The real test came when I would cook something and I would just see how long it would last on the kitchen table in the test kitchen. And those cupcakes were gone by the time I turned around.
The women that you meet along the way in particular, I mean, there are men in here as well, but, you know, the women who've sort of, through their cooking, become almost heroic in their towns. There's Cecilia Rosnowska's potato pancakes. She's in Chicago, Illinois. There's Hilda Minter's spicy escarole. She's in Birmingham, Alabama. This is such Molly O'Neill writing. If you don't mind, I'm just going to read a little bit from the beginning of Hilda Minter's story. In 1988, Hilda Minter's husband, Joe Minter, a retired construction worker, received a message from God directing him to create a sculpture park depicting the African-American spiritual experience in their backyard in the Woodland Park neighborhood of Birmingham. When her husband paid homage to the American working man by welding giant rusty wrenches to a cross, she made her favorite spicy escarole. When he was heralded as a visionary genius, she made bigger pots of escarole for the busloads who began to make pilgrimages to his sculpture park. "We were put here to make things and give them away," she said, and what follows is her escarole recipe.
Aww.
When you see that kind of a thing, that's human story attached to a recipe, how do you react?
I never stop being moved. These people who would allow me into their homes and their lives and really tell me their life story by making me something to eat. It's such an intimate and delightful and completely human way of connecting with another person. And I fell in love with places that I didn't expect to fall in love with. McAllen, Texas, Door County, Wisconsin, Lindsberg, Kansas. These are not places that were really high on my vacation dream list, but in fact, they're extraordinary spots in America.
How about Halibut Cove in Alaska?
Yeah.
I mean, Clem Tillion. Now, people credit him with saving Alaska's fishing industry. Tell us why.
Clem himself was a fisherman, and he realized very, very, very early on that fishermen had to impose their own limits, that fishermen had to become radical conservationists. He went to Washington and lobbied for radically conservative quotas and ways of controlling our catch. And, you know, people just despised him. And yet, without him, Alaska would not have a fisheries today. And many people say that it would not be an exaggeration to say that America would not have any fisheries today. And staying with that family and cooking with that family and making art with that family and eating with that family was a life-changing experience.
And we can get literally a taste of it, although I'm really nervous. I am going to try his cinnamon halibut, but it requires making a cinnamon oil the day before with toasted sesame oil and Chinese chili paste. You wrap the fish in plastic and put in the fridge for a while, that kind of a enterprise. But I feel
it's worth the effort. Yeah. And it looks more daunting on the page than it really is. And you can use that cinnamon oil over and over again.
You know, Molly O'Neill, we should say this isn't just a book. It's a website where people can contact you about the provenance of recipes or ask about, you know, how to get certain cooking equipment. And are you also still collecting recipes?
Oh, yes. I have so many more recipes and stories that I want to share. And once you start collecting, you can't really stop.
And if people try to whittle down what the great family recipe is, which you say is hard, you say you had one question for it, which is, which recipe embodies your life and times in your own personal America? If you could leave one recipe to your family, what would it be? This is so silly, but when I think of my mom, it would be the tuna noodle casserole with the potato chips on top.
Are you going to be sending me that recipe?
Well, yeah, I will. I mean, it's
okay, great.
It's silly, you know. It involved canned soup, but I mean, it just was real comfort food. And actually, after she passed, I found it in her old Betty Crocker, you know, cookbook.
Oh, you've got it.
I've got it.
Love you to send me that.
Okay, but in the meantime, what would be yours?
Either roasted chicken or a tartan. I'm not a baker, but I make a good tartan, and so many people have fallen for it that I kind of have had to accept the fact that even though I'm not a baker, a baked good probably tells my life story pretty well.
Well, you have to send us that.
Actually, it's up on the website, One Big Table.
Great. That's food writer Molly O'Neill. Oh, you can't do this again. Going off 10 years to do a book. We've missed you. But the book is astonishing. It's called One Big Table, A Portrait of American Cooking. For more and for the website she mentioned, you can go to herenow.org. Molly, thanks as always.
Thank you.